Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
People Fixing the World is the podcast looking for solutions to the problems we face today.
It could potentially ease the suffering of millions.
We have a solution. Let's do it.
People Fixing the World from the BBC World Service.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Janet Jalil, and in the early hours of Tuesday, the 16th of April, these are our main stories. Donald Trump has made legal history by becoming the first former US president to stand trial in a criminal case. Delegates at an aid conference in Paris, called to mark 1 year since Sudan's civil war began, have pledged more than $2 billion in donations. A movie weapons supervisor on the film Rushed has been sentenced to 18 months in prison for the fatal shooting of a cinematographer. Also in this podcast, record ocean temperatures have caused the mass bleaching of coral across the world's seas. We hear why the loss of the sound the coral makes is a disaster for marine life. Donald Trump's long-awaited hush money trial has begun in New York. It's the first time that a US president, former or current, has faced a criminal trial. Mr. Trump is accused of falsifying his business records to try to conceal a payment of $130,000 to an adult film star, Stormy Daniels, ahead of the 2016 election, which he won. He denies the charges and made this statement to reporters after leaving the courtroom in New York.
It's a scam trial. If you read all of the legal pundits, all of the legal scholars today, there's not one that I see that said this is a case that should be brought or tried. It's a scam. It's a political witch hunt. It continues, and it continues forever. And we're not going to be given a fair trial. It's a very, very sad thing.
The initial phase of jury selection saw dozens of potential jurors excused after saying they could not be impartial. Our correspondent, Neda Torfik, was at the court and gave us this update.
This is, of course, the first former president to face criminal charges, but we have to remember this is happening as he's also seeking a return to the White House. And so for both of those reasons, we are really seeing Donald Trump test both the political and legal norms of this country in a way no one ever has before. You think back to Nixon and Watergate. Well, Gerald Ford pardoned the former President Nixon. And so certainly this has leapt the United States into unprecedented territory and has raised all sorts of questions about what happens if Donald Trump is convicted in this case.
Just talk us through how this will unfold. This is just the first day. A jury needs to be selected before the trial can begin, and that's likely to be a long, difficult process.
That's exactly right. And keep in mind that a lot of times they say cases are won or lost on jury selection. That's how important this process is. And that's because jurors will either vote at the end to say that Donald Trump is guilty, not guilty, or if they can't decide, if just one juror holds up a unanimous decision, it could be a hung jury, which would result in a mistrial. Now, these are people that are going to be answering what the judge has described as the most extensive questionnaire the court has put forward. More than 40 questions on that questionnaire that deal with what kind of media they consume, if they've ever gone to a Trump rally, if they're part of any extremist groups. And then both sides will be able to strike out certain jurors they don't want. There'll be further questioning to ensure that jurors picked can be impartial, no matter how they feel about Donald Trump as a person. And so that could take a week to 2 weeks. We'll see how that process unfolds. But altogether, this trial is expected to last up to 8 weeks.
And I think what a lot of people will find surprising is that even if Mr. Trump is found guilty and put in prison, he could still possibly become president.
That's absolutely right. It is a matter for the voters. This is perhaps the only one of the four criminal trials he faces that is going to happen before the election in November. And so in that sense, many say it's playing a little bit of an outsized role. How will that impact, for example, independent voters? I mean, if you look at polling, Donald Trump and Joe Biden are neck to neck. So even if he is a convicted felon as a result of this trial, he would not only be able to run, but be able to serve as president if he wins. Now, many say it's unlikely he'll get jail time in this case, because even though the sentencing guidelines call for up to 4 years of prison, somebody who is a first-time offender, for example, can often get probation. Ultimately, that's a decision that's up for the judge. But if Donald Trump, for example, was sent to prison and was elected president, well, that just throws the United States into, again, uncharted territory.
Neda Torfik. Well, some more bad news for Donald Trump. The value of shares in the social media site he launched has fallen sharply following the announcement of plans to allow investors, including the former president, to sell them. Our North America business correspondent, Michelle Fleury, reports from New York.
The company behind the Truth Social platform has told financial regulators that it plans to issue almost 21.5 million new shares to the public to raise more money. Trump Media is also looking for approval to potentially resell up to 146 million shares held by current investors, including the former president, who is the majority shareholder. The move paves the way for them to be able to cash in sooner. Currently, they are barred from any share sale until September. Once the Securities and Exchange Commission signs off on this filing, insiders, including Mr. Trump, can seek board approval to start selling stock. The price of Trump Media's shares dropped almost 13% shortly after the U.S. stock market opened, extending its slump. The struggling company, which went public in March, is rapidly losing money, and a new stock offering could help it stay afloat.
Michelle Fleury. An international conference in Paris has raised more than $2 billion in financial support for Sudan. It's been a year since civil war erupted between the army and a rival paramilitary group called the Rapid Support Forces. Around 9 million people have been displaced since then, and tens of millions are facing a hunger crisis. But much of the global attention has been focused on other conflicts. The head of the United Nations, Antonio Guterres, called on the international community to provide more aid.
The Sudanese people desperately need the support and generosity of the global community to help them through this nightmare. The $2.7 billion humanitarian response plan for Sudan was only 6% funded before the conference. And $1.4 billion regional refugee response plan for the Sudan crisis, only 7%.
Tim Frank spoke to Isabel Coleman, the Deputy Administrator of USAID, the United States Agency for International Development. She's been attending the conference in Paris. So what's her reaction to the aid pledge there for Sudan?
We're thrilled with the outcome today. Sudan is one of the worst humanitarian crises in the world today. And I think prior to this event, the commitments for this year for Sudan were woefully insufficient. The UN does an appeal every year, and last year they met over 40% of that appeal, with the United States alone contributing more than $1 billion to Sudan. This year, the humanitarian response plan had been woefully met to date, around 5 or 6%. And today's pledging conference really goes a long way to really making up the gap that existed.
Right. I mean, you mentioned that the US last year contributed $1 billion. I mean, the figures that I've got from USAID in terms of what's been committed to them in the 2024 fiscal year has Sudan at about $200 million. In your sort of list of top 10 recipients, it's comes in number 7. So is that where we are in the current financial year?
Yes, it starts October 1. So we're about halfway through our current financial year.
Okay. But I mean, it does suggest that despite the fact that you and others are describing it as one of the world's worst humanitarian crises, I mean, just in terms of the amount of money that the US has pledged just in the last 6 months, I mean, it's not as much as some other places.
you're looking just at the USAID figures.
Yeah.
And our State Department also contributes funding.
Okay. When it comes to getting humanitarian aid in, I mean, what we're hearing again and again, and I'm sure you're hearing the same thing from the people that you're speaking to, is that it may be good news that more money is now being pledged, but, I mean, obviously aid is about more than just figures. It's also about distribution. What can you possibly do to try and make that better, smoother, whilst conflict is raging inside Sudan?
Well, that is the task of humanitarian heroes around the world, and it's no different in this case in Sudan. I mean, we, as the U.S. government, have been putting a lot of effort into the diplomacy on this conflict, and I know that my government colleagues are doing everything they can with both parties to the conflict, both the RSF and the SAF, to increase both cross-border and cross-line within the country access to those who need it most for humanitarian assistance.
I'm sure efforts are being made, but I mean, what we've seen over the last year is looting from the RSF and their forces, their paramilitary forces, and incredible bureaucratic obstacles placed in the way of the distribution of aid by the regular army, the Sudanese armed forces. I mean, not to say, of course, the fact that the insecurity and the fragmented forces that are now piling in just means that it's incredibly difficult and dangerous work to do. So I'm sure efforts are being made, but what is going to change this?
Getting the parties back to the negotiating table is absolutely urgent. And as part of that, making it very clear that starving the people of Sudan is not only against international humanitarian law, but, you know, potentially a war crime. I mean, making sure that the perpetrators really understand that what they're doing, and getting their political backers in the region to really bring pressure to bear on them too.
Isabel Coleman of USAID. The world is watching closely to see what Israel's next move will be following Iran's unprecedented attack on the Jewish state on Saturday night. Israel's war cabinet met for a second day on Monday and is vowing to respond despite countries including France and Britain urging against an escalation. The United States has said it won't take part in any Israeli counterattack against Iran. Tehran says it launched hundreds of missiles and drones on Saturday night in revenge for an attack on its consulate in Syria earlier this month that killed senior Iranian officials. Israel managed to intercept nearly all of them with the help of allies, including the US, the UK and Jordan. James Landell reports from Jerusalem.
It's now clear that Israel will retaliate against Iran for the mass missile and drone attack it launched over the weekend. In a statement on social media, Mr. Netanyahu accused Iran of conducting a full-scale campaign of aggression that threatens not only Israel, but also the entire Middle East. The international community, he said, must continue to stand united in resisting that aggression. The head of Israel's army, Herzi Halevi, visited the Nevatim airbase that was lightly damaged.
As we look ahead, we consider our steps, and this launch of so many missiles, cruise missiles and drones into the territory of the State of Israel will be met with a response.
Israel's war cabinet met for the second time in 24 hours amid growing rumours that some kind of retaliatory action was imminent. But it was also reported the cabinet was divided about how and when. That uncertainty was reflected on the streets of Jerusalem.
What I really think has to happen is we need to hit them. We need to hit them hard. They need to realize this is not the kind of behavior that can be tolerated. I'm not recommending that we destroy their nuclear facilities, but if they did it, I wouldn't have a problem with it.
We don't need to do anything in a rush. We should wait with it because revenge is a meal that should be presented cold.
I'd like Israel to respond, but I also know that there are more complicated things, and there's a whole world to think about, and the entire Middle East can burn in a second. So I would hope that they can make the smart, responsible decision.
Local media said the government wanted to hurt Iran for the attack without causing all-out war. They said ministers also wanted to act in coordination with the US. American officials have already made clear the US would not take part in any military action against Iran. Even though only 2 days have passed since the unprecedented Iranian attack, there was still space for political disagreement. Israel's opposition leader Yair Lapid accused the Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu of presiding over a total loss of Israeli deterrence. Mr. Netanyahu later summoned some opposition leaders for a security briefing, but Mr. Lapid was not included. Iran's foreign ministry spokesman, Nasser Kanani, sought to justify his country's attack on Israel. Tonight in Israel, ministers were still considering their response to what Iran called its restraint. All the while, Western allies urged the same on them.
James Landell in Jerusalem. The price of oil has fallen slightly after Iran's attack on Israel. Rising tensions in the Middle East had caused prices to increase in recent weeks, but they've dropped back again, as Theo Leggett explains.
For weeks, traders and analysts have viewed the rising tensions between Israel and Iran with growing concern. This has pushed up prices, with the cost of Brent crude rising from $85 a barrel in mid-March to just over $92 on Friday. However, the limited impact of the attacks themselves, coupled with the clear diplomatic pressure on Israel to avoid escalation, appear to have given the market some reassurance. As a result, oil prices have fallen back slightly, but remain high.
Theo Leggett. Coral reefs don't just make for stunning pictures or exciting scuba diving adventures. They play a vital role in sustaining underwater ecosystems. But climate scientists have long warned that coral is under threat from warming ocean temperatures. Now, after 10 consecutive months of record temperatures, the world has experienced its fourth global mass coral bleaching event, affecting more than half of the world's reefs. Jennifer McWhorter is from the U.S. National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration.
Coral bleaching is when the water in the ocean gets too warm and the algae that lives in the coral's tissue leaves the animal because it's too hot and it's stressed. And so the corals appear bleached because they've lost that algae in their tissue. If the coral dies, then the animal is dead and eventually we start losing function on the reef. This is a habitat for lots of different organisms, from invertebrates to fish. You're going to be losing that structure and that habitat even more.
Our climate reporter, Georgina Ranard, told us more about what this all means.
It basically means that there's been all this heat growing in the ocean for the past year, mostly driven by climate change because the oceans absorb much of the heating that we're putting into the atmosphere, and a bit caused by El Niño, this natural climate fluctuation, which also increases sea surface temperatures. And that's been going on, and now we're seeing the first evidence of just what that building heat in the oceans is doing to this coral.
And that's basically the impact of the past 10 months of record temperatures that we've been talking about so much.
Exactly. So we've been going on and on about these climate records being broken, and now we're really seeing the global evidence of those impacts. Coral is this amazing, sort of very sensitive ecosystem. It's beautiful and provides this vast structure in the oceans for creatures to live on. Around 25% of marine life depends on these cities that the coral reefs build. But it's very sensitive. So as soon as temperatures increase above their limit, their sort of maximum limit, they really quickly feel that stress. And then they become sick and diseased. And if that heat goes on for long enough, they do start to die. And this is across all oceans, the Atlantic, the Indian, the Pacific. But, you know, most famously, we probably know the Great Barrier Reef in Australia. And scientists there have been diving and doing aerial surveys and watching this bleaching. And in some places, around 20-25% of the coral has actually already died.
And this bleaching is quite a slow process. So can it be stopped or even reversed?
Absolutely. So it does take a long time for the coral to die, and it can recover. It's a bit like a human. If they get stressed, the body responds in sort of different ways. And if you have enough time to recover, you can. But the problem with this coral is that a lot of it is experiencing multiple heat episodes, and it doesn't have the time to recover.
And when we think of coral, we often think of very beautiful colours. But actually, the sound that coral makes is very important.
Yes, absolutely. So we think of these fluorescent colours. These huge reefs also produce lots of sound, creaking and singing. And it's partly that which support all of this marine life. So one example is fish use those sounds to find their way home. It's a guide and they navigate using it. They go home to breed and spawn the next generations. And then when the coral dies, obviously they use that navigation sign, and some of these fish are unable to find their way home.
That was Georgina Ranard. And if you want to read more on this story, head to our science pages on bbc.com. Still to come.
The Standard Model is a model we've had for about a quarter of a century now, and it's a model that describes our expanding universe, began with a hot Big Bang.
But have astronomers got it all wrong? Do they need to revise their theories?
You've heard of Charlie Chaplin, right?
Well, Charlie Chaplin was my grandfather, and there was a time when he was the biggest star in all the world. But something happened, not just to him, but to hundreds of artists in Hollywood. They were forced to leave, forced out.
All episodes of Hollywood Exiles from the BBC World Service and CBC are available now. Search for Hollywood Exiles wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to the Global News Podcast. A controversial bill being discussed in the Georgian Parliament on Monday led to a brawl erupting between opposing members in the chamber. The incident was captured on the Parliament's live feed. Mamouka Medina Radza of the ruling Green Party was speaking from the dispatch box when he was struck by an opposition MP, Aleko Elishashvili. This then provoked a wider fight with other politicians getting involved before the feed was cut. The bill has been dubbed the Russian law and would require organisations that accept funds from abroad to register as foreign agents or face fines. Such is the opposition to it in Georgia that thousands of demonstrators protested outside the parliament. Our reporter, Rehan Dimitri, was among them.
To be honest, I have a sense of déjà vu because I was covering this same story last year. There were mass, huge protests. That was the time when the Georgian government, it was the first attempt to pass this law. And last year, it was called the Foreign Agents Law. Last year, the Georgian government was forced to back off and they cancelled their plans to pass the law because of the mass protests. And to a lot of people's kind of astonishment earlier this month, they said, look, we're going to bring this law back. We're just changing the title. Now it's called on the transparency of foreign funding. But the content of the law remains unchanged. Last year, people were chanting no to the Russian law, and it has been the main slogan today as well. So many people are here because they believe that this law is something that will take the country back to Russia's orbit. Numerous polls show that the vast majority of Georgians, over 80%, see their country's future as part of the EU. And therefore, there's such a large rally today. People are saying our future is with Europe. And I can see so many people wrapped in EU flags and Georgian flags, and they're holding banners that read no to the Russian law.
And the protests are not just outside Parliament, they're inside Parliament too. In fact, we had that scuffle.
Yes, earlier today there was a scuffle when one opposition MP, he punched the head of the parliamentary faction, the Georgian Dream government's faction. I actually saw this MP a short while ago. He has a bruise on his forehead and he said that he was beaten up. And the interesting thing is that so many people were trying to take selfies, young people were trying to take selfies with him. I spoke to some of these people. They were just young people, 15 years old, saying, you know, he expressed something that we all feel. That's why they're all very supportive, even though it was violence, of course, inside Parliament.
Do you think the governing party can push this bill through, given this level of opposition?
I think we'll have to wait and see. It's very difficult to predict, but given the size of the crowd today and the mood among people, that they're so determined
They're saying that they are fighting for their future, and they really see it as a clear cut. You know, either Georgia goes forward towards Europe or back to Russia.
Rehan Dimitri. Croatians will be heading to the polls on Wednesday for parliamentary elections, and it's become a battle pitting the Prime Minister against the President. Prime Minister Andrej Plenković is hoping to win a third term for the ruling right-wing HDZ party. But his longtime rival, President Zoran Milanovic, has declared himself as a possible head of government if the centre-left coalition wins. If nothing else, the president's move has livened up what might otherwise have been a predictable poll, as our correspondent Guy Delaunay reports from Croatia's capital, Zagreb.
Rivers of justice. That's the rallying cry of Croatia's centre-left opposition parties ahead of polling day. They accuse the governing HDZ party of corruption and cronyism, and they say that's been driving tens of thousands of young Croatians to leave the country every year. Sandra Benčić is the main candidate of the Green Left Party, Možemo.
People who are HDZ actually get the jobs or promotions or better salaries. This hopelessness that it will not change pushes people across the border, and most of them do not get back.
When he announced the election date, President Zoran Milanovic declared that he would be the centre-left's candidate for prime minister. That electrified the race due to his popularity. But the Constitutional Court swiftly ruled that the president was ineligible. In return, Mr. Milanovic accused the judges of doing the government's bidding.
That gangster clique has taken the court hostage. Such peasants are illiterate, so it's a problem, because that means the decision is also illiterate.
Despite the court ban on his candidacy, the president's been travelling around the country meeting supporters. Officially, he's not been campaigning, but there seems little doubt that he'd resign to take up the prime minister's post if the centre-left won. The event we've got on here is basically promoting sport for young people, but it's also being co-opted by the governing party of Croatia, the HDZ, with Prime Minister Andrej Plenković due to make an appearance.
What is relevant that the Croats are provided with the government and with the parliamentary majority, which will ensure stability over the next 4 years and create conditions for economic growth and social cohesion.
Is it damaging for Croatia to have this sort of competition between the President and the Prime Minister?
Well, it's bizarre, but I'm trying to sort of minimize the negative effects of this unconstitutional acts.
The Prime Minister might not like it, but the candidate who isn't a candidate remains the one to watch. And while he remains president, Zoran Milanovic will also have a major role to play in the formation of Croatia's next government. Whichever way you look at it, in this election, he's very much taking centre stage.
Guy Delaunay reporting from the Croatian capital, Zagreb. The weapons supervisor who loaded the gun that killed a cinematographer on the set of the US film Rust has been sentenced to 18 months in prison. Hannah Gutierrez-Reed was found guilty of involuntary manslaughter in March. The actor Alec Baldwin was holding the gun when it fired and killed Helena Hutchins during rehearsals in New Mexico in 2021. Emma Vardy reports from Los Angeles.
Hannah Gutierrez-Reed, who's 26, was given the maximum sentence by the judge after her conviction. During her trial, she'd been called careless and reckless for having mixed up live rounds in a box of the dummy rounds that were being used on set. In court, she said she'd made a mistake but was not a monster. The judge said she'd neither remorse nor regret. Alec Baldwin is due to face a trial in July for the same charge. His defence will argue that it was Gutierrez-Reed's responsibility to ensure the gun was safe, but if found guilty, he too could be sentenced to jail.
Emma Vardy. The electric car maker Tesla is to lay off more than 10% of its global workforce. The company has begun to feel the impact of slowing global demand for EVs. It's due to report its quarterly earnings this month, but has already announced a decline in vehicle deliveries so far this year. Here's our technology reporter, Shiona McCullum.
The news of the job losses was circulated to staff on email, with the firm's billionaire owner Elon Musk saying he'd made the difficult decision to reduce the headcount by more than 10%. That works out at more than 14,000 employees. He said there was nothing he hated more than letting people go, but it had to be done to enable the company to be lean and innovative. Tesla's earnings have been below market expectations as it faces increased competition and cheaper electric cars, mainly from China. It is not yet known where the cuts will take place across the business, but two well-known executives have confirmed that they will be departing.
Shona Cullum, we've learned a lot about space and the universe in the last 100 or so years, but there's still so much we don't know. And at the Royal Society in London this week, a meeting for scientists has been taking place called Challenging the Standard Cosmological Model. It looks at whether we've got a lot wrong in our thinking about how the universe works. Evan Davis spoke to Professor Wendy Freeman from the Department of Astronomy and Astrophysics at the University of Chicago, who was at the conference.
The standard model is a model we've had for about a quarter of a century now, and it's a model that describes our expanding universe, began with a hot Big Bang, and it describes the composition of the universe as being made up of matter and energy. And most of the matter in the universe turns out to be in a form that's dark, it doesn't emit radiation. And most of the energy density of the universe turns out to be in another, we call dark energy, a dark form that's causing the universe to speed up in its expansion.
Right. So that explains how it's speeding up, the energy yes. that's creating the expansion. Right. If that's the standard model, what are the problems? What are the data points, if you like, that say, hang on, there's some issues with this model. It doesn't quite explain everything.
Yeah, there are a number of anomalies that have surfaced in recent years. And one of those is that when we measure the expansion rate of the universe at the current time, measure it locally, it doesn't agree with the measurements that are coming from measurements of the background radiation early in the universe. And so we live in one universe. Those numbers ought to line up. And according to some studies, they don't. So that's one anomaly that has surfaced. And there are others in the density fluctuations of matter compared to the fluctuations in radiation. And there are a number of others. So the group here is assembled to try and understand, are there anomalies that would break the current standard model? Are there things that we're missing, new physics that we could learn about? And so we're actively debating those right. kinds of issues.
Right. Now, are you all there just picking at the current model, at the model we described, or just sort of tweaking, looking at it and saying this doesn't work, that doesn't work, or is there an alternative view, an alternative model of what the universe is doing, how it's structured?
Yeah, I think that's one of the interesting issues right now. There's not another model that has surfaced that can explain all the anomalies. And we know historically that these kinds of anomalies, the significance of them varies, and some of them will strengthen with time as we get more and more data, and some of them will disappear. And those are the kinds of things that we argue about. I think what's really exciting for us is that there's a lot of new data that just coming into being now that we're considering. And the future for the next decade looks really promising in terms of the strength of the surveys and the statistics that will come out of those new surveys. But I think also what's interesting is that despite an awful lot of effort to try and find other models that might better explain the universe, that's been very difficult to do. The standard model has proved very difficult to supersede.
Isn't it a donut? I saw the alternative model is that it's a donut or a kind of two horned back to back, a sort of different shape, and it's not really expanding. It's the same size, but bits are expanding and other bits are contracting. We just haven't spotted that.
You know, it's very hard to come up with a model that will explain all of the data that we see at any one time. And so the standard model has curiously proved to be very robust, which isn't to say that there won't be some new data that will really show that there's a problem with the standard model and a new theory that will explain that. But it hasn't emerged yet.
Professor Wendy Freeman. And that's all from us for now, but there will be a new edition of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. You can also find us on X at Global News Pod. This edition was mixed by Alicia Thursting. The producer was Leah McSheffrey. The editor is Karen Martin. I'm Janat Jalil. Until next time, goodbye.
You've heard of Charlie Chaplin, right? Well, Charlie Chaplin was my grandfather, and there was a time when he was the biggest star in all the world. But something happened, not just to him, but to hundreds of artists in Hollywood. They were forced to leave, forced out.
All episodes of Hollywood Exiles from the BBC World Service and CBC are available now. Search for Hollywood Exiles wherever you get your podcasts.